Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Welcome one, welcome all. This is The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. Thanks once again for joining us. I'm Will Kelleher, Deputy Rugby Correspondent of The Times, and today I'm joined by my big boss, Alex Lowe, the correspondent.
Hello, Hello Will.
How's
Hello.
It going?
Giving him the hot seat today.
And we are privileged to be joined by King Freelancer, Adam Hathaway.
The return of the dog man.
How are the dogs?
Not great at the moment, mate. Yeah, we haven't got any at the moment, but we'll be investing in another one soon.
Right, okay. So as avid readers of rugby, you'll have seen Adam's name all over the place. And Adam, you were at 3 games in the weekend, that's right?
Yep, saw Gloucester chuck it away on Friday night, saw Quinn's nick it on Saturday, and saw Sarries dominate yesterday.
What did you make of it? Where was your best of the weekend?
Probably yesterday, the way Saracens turned it on in the second half. We're going to talk about him all programme, I think. Prime Farrell was brilliant.
Yeah. You were there as well, Alex? What did you make of all that?
Yeah, Mark McCall is never one to get carried away with his comments, and so when he describes Owen Farrell's performance was phenomenal. You know how good it was. I mean, in my piece this morning, just made the point that McCall is saying that if you ask Farrell, Farrell will say he still isn't on top of his game. Yeah, he's only played 4 club matches since October. Mm. And yet he's dominated Cardiff last week and was just at the heart of everything that Saracens did so well second half yesterday as they came back from 15-10 down at half time, and you just saw a guy who looks physically, he looks stacked after all that time off. And emotionally, just I mean, he is the heartbeat of that team, and you saw it. He was brilliant. Yeah.
If Mark McCall's not going to get carried away about Owen, can I please?
Yeah, go on.
Some of the things he did yesterday and the week before against Cardiff, if Bowden Barrett or Marcus Smith had done that, we'd have an open-top bus parade. The guy was fantastic. Just because you're tough doesn't mean you can't be skillful. He's both.
So the one marquee moment I saw from that game was a nice little dummy and then a 50-yard break. I don't think I've seen Farrell do that for years.
No, it felt like, I think we were talking afterwards, just chatting in the press room about, you know, when was the last time we saw him play this well? Mm. And it does feel like he's got a lot of frustration built up in him from so long. He's so used to playing every game. He is tough, as Adam says, but it feels like maybe in that time away that he's just used it. He's using it as fuel, and he's not, you know, he's a very structured player. He's very tough, but that doesn't, as Adam said, doesn't mean he isn't skillful. It doesn't mean he doesn't see opportunities. And he plays in a team that manage the game so well. Mm. That it isn't always, he's not required to do that. They don't play like that. You know, we're used to seeing Marcus Smith do that. We're used to seeing Bowden Barrett do that, Adam. We're not used to seeing Owen do it, not because he can't do it, but because of the way he tends to play and the way Saracens are set up to play. And for so long recently, the way England have been set up to play, it doesn't require him to do that or even look for that. And there was, it was a mistake from Jack Yandel. He sort of overran the chasing defence. The door opened, Farrell was through it. And actually, it wasn't just that break, which was great, but the pass he chose on the run out to Alex Lewington, who was subsequently tackled. But there were easier options. But the way he threaded that pass on the run that allowed Alex Lewington to catch it without breaking stride, it's those moments that Mark McCall was referring to. The accuracy.
Was that really angly fizzed across, wasn't it?
Yeah, accuracy of his execution was brilliant. And we've seen that in those four games since he's come back. His skill level I think it has dipped at times as he's, I think, you know, he carries the burden of captaincy with England and the pressure and maybe overplaying long seasons, Lions. He was playing in a championship, didn't test him in the same way. Just the feel that one of the things I've noticed since he's come back is the accuracy of his execution has been top class.
Yeah, and I suppose we forget, I mean, he's only just over 30, 100 caps now for England, plus all the Lions ones as well. He's got plenty left. I mean, he could be one of these Johnny Sexton characters, couldn't he? He just keeps going and going and going. It doesn't look like he's fading, does it?
Yeah, because he's not a fly half who relies on gas. Like he's not the quickest 10 out there, but that's not his game. He's fast enough to make a break, but it's the speed of thought and the accuracy of execution, and that's where Johnny Sexton's evolved his game into. And you can absolutely see Owen playing on. And I'm sure we'll come back to him as the pod goes on. But yeah, he was outstanding on Sunday.
I'm sure he can play till he's 35, 36. It seems weird, like you said, as a guy with 100 caps, and he's underappreciated and underrated, I think.
Well, we will maybe round off that. We could have already teed up our God of the Week there. But before we crack on with everything else, let's just run through what we're going to go through on the podcast today. We're going to look back at the weekend in the Gallagher Premiership. England's Marley Packer joins us to preview La Crunch in the Women's Six Nations as England play France. Both teams looking to win a Grand Slam there. Jess Aden has a roundup of all the other action in the women's game. And we will name our God or Goddess of the Week. But first, let's get into a bit more of the Premiership. Right, so let's get on to the round 23 of the Premiership. We usually only have 22, but we've got more teams now, so we're on 23 and there's still more to go. But we did talk a bit about Owen Farrell to start with, but there's the wider thing of Saracens just quietly, as he said after the game, going under the radar a little bit. We're talking a lot about Leicester at the moment, but Saris are back in the playoffs. Since they've been, well, when they've been in the Premiership, they haven't missed one since they lost their first final in 2009-10, so not a bad effort, and it's always felt inexorable that they're kind of always going to get there, hasn't it? What do we think about their performance and how they're tracking? Are they going under the radar? Can you go under the radar of Saracens, Hathers?
They're not going under my radar because they're my local team. The nearest team to me. Well, I think we're destined to get a Saris Leicester final, which would be an absolute humdinger. It was interesting that they've kind of sort of rested and rotated as well. Leicester have done a lot of that as well, although we are constantly told that they pick the team who's going to play the best on Saturday. And then you look at the team sheet, it's totally different, but there you go. Saris, they're not under the radar. I reckon they're going to win the whole thing.
Yeah.
I think they are trying to sort of stay a bit under the radar. This is a real kind of in-media point, but they're the club that says the least.
Yeah.
You know, they're the hardest club to line up an interview with. Ben Earl did speak last week, and he was fascinating on a lot of the work that's happening behind the scenes there, and that's helped him develop. And he was outstanding. We've talked a lot about Owen Farrell. He was outstanding again on Sunday.
Seventh try of the season as well.
Seventh try of the season. Yeah, the conversation that I had with him last week was all about the fact he's also top of the tackle chart. So he's actually scored more tries this season than he did playing for Bristol last season in the league, when he was popping up off Semi Randrandra, but it's his tackling and his defence that he's most proud of, actually. And he said, I think that was the point that Eddie Jones kept making about his game was defence. And he obviously, he's playing in the same position as Sam Underhill, Tom Curry, where tackle count is and dominant tackles are massive, chop tackles, and I think he's really built on that. But the wider point, I think they are trying to stay a bit quiet, but their performances are you can't ignore them as they're building towards the end of the season. Mark McCall was saying after the game, you know, Mark McCall very softly spoken, surrounded by loads of fans, was just saying, you know, we've had to kind of find a way through to this point using 45, 46 players. They've had Vunipola at 10, they've had Good at 10, they've had, you know, Lozovsky playing this game on Sunday against Exeter. You know, they didn't have Max Malians, they didn't have Itoje, they didn't have Mako, who's obviously still out, didn't have Max Malians. But they were rocked a bit in that second quarter. But they just came out firing and overwhelmed Exeter. And I just feel that they took a bit of time to adapt, to come back. You know, they didn't really, as we saw with England, they kind of walked through the championship season. They've had to rebuild the squad to a degree. They've got positions where I don't think they have enormous strength, but they're good enough. Scrum half, I think, you know, they're good enough. But it's not a position of, when you think back to Saracens in years gone by, of, you know, Wigglesworth and de Kock and Spencer, it's not a position of enormous strength, but it's good enough. And they're sort of finding a way through. But I think they feel they are starting to come to the boil. And I think it was just fascinating for me that Farrell feels like now he's back, starting to come to the boil, as are Saracens. You'd think it'd be a Saracens Harlequins semi-final in North London.
That's,
you
know, just be...
how juicy is that?
Yeah.
I'll tell you one guy who, if Saracens are flying under the radar, he seems to fly under the radar, but he's playing the rugby of his life, is Sean Maitland, who's been fantastic this season.
I'll tell you, Theo McFarlane, who Steve Jones was referring to last week, outstanding, they're six, just...
Dual international.
Yeah, just everywhere, brilliant. He was brilliant too.
That, so I remember doing an early season interview when Saracens were back in the Prem with Jackson Ray and Nick Tompkins, and I sort of asked them a bit of a cheeky question of, do you reckon if you were in the league, Quins would have won the title? And they were polite, but they were like,
of course not.
If they could say what they thought, they would have said, are you joking? So that would be incredible, wouldn't it? Properly contrasting styles. There's so much beef going back decade or so between those sides, people in the coaching boxes who don't like each other either, like, that'd be really, really tasty.
And actually, what we were talking about before about Farrell and the way he can play, I mean, and we will talk about this game a lot if it does end up happening, which we think it will. They won't want to get drawn into a Harlequins style. So that day will be absolutely vintage Saracens Farrell.
Yeah,
play, you know, manage it, close it down, play physical.
Just on another quick point, which, I don't know, it was made at the time, but I feel like is getting proved now, is that all those years where they were over the salary cap now look like totally unnecessary, because they didn't need to have the stacked team, because they're good enough with the compliant team.
Yeah, but if you look at their bench sometimes, it's nothing like the bench they would have had 5 years ago. They're still second in the league, yeah, for sure.
And largely better than most teams.
And like Alex said, they haven't got depth in every position. Like I said, scrum half obviously is one. I still think they miss Brad Barrett a bit, to be honest.
Yeah. But their academies has always been so good. And one of the issues in that salary cap thing, we know, was an embarrassment of riches that their academy had produced.
Yeah, exactly.
This generation of players. And I remember being there with Mark McCall saying, you know, they're all now England players, still on early contracts. And he's like, I don't know how we're going to keep hold of them all. And of course they did. And then
we
know how. But it's actually some of the other players that that they had in that setup, that
the Skeltons and the Liam Williams types.
Probably didn't
those
need
guys.
I mean,
yeah,
we could do another podcast about getting penalised for producing England players. I think it's ridiculous. Exeter are suffering a bit from
that. Well, that's what I was just going to say. A nice segue to that, because Exeter have had this season has been an odd one for them. And actually, Rob Baxter was sort of slightly tongue in cheek saying, if our crash and burn season is coming fourth or fifth, then a lot of other clubs would take that. But it does, and Mark Evans has mentioned it a little bit on this podcast, that they're on the cusp of a little rebuild, a mini rebuild possibly, with guys like Skinner leaving and Tomo Flacherty leaving and Johnny Hill leaving, and largely because they can't afford to keep them all on the same salaries. And if they get targeted by other teams, then they can't afford to keep them all. So what do we think of Exeter? They challenged them, but they ultimately were defeated. And now it looks unlikely that they're going to make another final, really, doesn't it? If the playoffs at all.
So, Rob, they've got this week off, so they'll sit and watch as...
They're all at Jack Noel's wedding, I think, as we are recording.
They are,
this.
Yeah, today. Yeah, so it's probably just as well they're not playing this weekend, because I imagine that will not be a short affair.
No.
They've got this week off, so they'll sit and wait. And then Rob Baxter is still confident that if they can win their last two, they'll be in fourth. The last two are not the easiest. Bristol and then Harlequins.
Mm.
I feel that they were obviously... The style of play was affected by the law change and the latch and both the end of the latch that, you know, you're now not allowed to pre-bind effectively, and also the goal line dropout. Mm. You know, that had an impact on the way they played. And it was also fascinating on Sunday that, you know, that Henry Slade ended up at fly half ahead of Joe Simmons, and Rob's explanation was that they know that Joe Simmons isn't playing as well as he can play. And I actually thought Slade did a really, you know, he is a good. I've seen him play 10 for England Saxons, and he's an elegant, wonderful playmaker.
But hadn't played there for 5 years.
But he was at the heart of everything. He did well in that first half, particularly that second quarter. But it's just indicative of a club where things aren't quite connecting in the way that they want. You know, they're so used to, you know, Ewers and Armand trucking it up and making all the hits, and then Sam Simmons flying off the back. Well, you know, neither of those three were playing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, they didn't have Harry Williams either. I mean, they were missing players too. Jack Noel was out, obviously, as well. They are in a bit of a reset year, and the salary cap will start to impact them. You know, as Baxter said to us the other week, for a piece in the paper, you know, he would never have imagined a Scotland international lock choosing to leave Exeter to go back to Scotland on salary alone.
Yeah.
But that's what's happening.
Yeah.
And so they're in a bit of a rebuild mode. And it's one of those things you never think you'd back against Exeter because of what they've done over the last period of time. Just struggle to see that they'll make it this time.
Yeah.
Well, I reckon they might nick fourth because a lot of the teams who are going for fourth are playing each other or playing Quins and Saris.
Yeah, well, let's run through that, because so we've got the three who are in most likely position to take fourth. We've got Northampton, who've got Quins at home on Friday, then Saracens away, then they finish with Newcastle. Exeter, as we've said, have got a bye week this week, then they go away to Bristol, and then end at home to Quins. And then Gloucester are playing Bath on this Saturday, Quins away, and then Saris at home. So it's Quins and Saris, the kingmakers of this little race for the top four. It's going to be fascinating, isn't it?
Well, I reckon that result on Friday has done a lot of damage to Gloucester going down to Bristol, because they could have had a real jump up the table last week. They got the 5 points for the Worcester
cancellation,
COVID cancellation. They should have beaten Bristol. I reckon they've shot themselves in the foot there.
Yeah, so who do we think's in the driving? It's so hard to say, isn't it, with Exeter having played a game more and then having a bye week. I mean, as you mentioned, Rob Baxter was saying after the game on Sunday that he thinks that when they come back and play, they'll probably need to win two games to get into the top four. Which horses are we backing?
But it's going to be bonus points, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
To me,
like a number of wins, maybe even.
So even if you just look at the straight fixtures from now, you'd think, you know, if any of them can stay tight within seven, get a losing bonus in one of the tougher games, or if Gloucester can put Bath to the sword, or if Saints can put Newcastle to the sword on the last day with a 5-point win.
Would you really fancy Northampton to beat Quins and Saris in successive weeks?
No, but then I wouldn't back Gloucester to beat Quins and Saris in successive weeks either.
Yeah, that's why I think Exeter would come fourth.
Would you back Exeter to beat... You know, if you look at the last four weekends, including the one that's just gone,
yeah,
all three of them have got to play Saracens and Exeter, Saracens and Quins.
Mm.
Exeter just lost to Saracens, and they've got to play Quins as well. So, if you take it as a chunk, they've all got to play those two teams. So it's how can they do in the other games, I think, and what can they sneak a losing bonus in one of those games, while also, you know, Exeter, you know, will need a 5-pointer against Bristol, you'd imagine. Saints will need a 5-pointer against Newcastle. Gloucester will need a 5-pointer against Bath. And then it could be about how they do. Can they scrape something in one of the other games?
So an added point, and it was, you did a big piece with Leicester on Saturday's paper, Alex, and they obviously changed their team because they're trying to now get into the European semi-final in a couple of weeks against Leinster, as well as trying to win the league. No one else has really got that scenario. Saracens are in the Challenge Cup still, but we'll rotate their team for that. But now they're in the playoffs, and Quins is probably going to be the next team that are definitely qualified. Is there going to be a scenario possibly on the last day where one of the stronger teams doesn't need to win, whereas the team they're playing do, and that affects the selection and possibly the result?
Yeah, potentially. So, yeah, Leicester rested. They rested a lot of players, and they put on the bench of, you know,
Cole, Genge, Visa,
and they've got, because they've got Quins, and then they've got the Premiership Cup game this week, London Irish, on Tuesday night. Then they got Bristol, and then they've got Leinster. So they were just, they're having to manage resources. So so that they compete for Leinster, because they're already in the playoffs. They probably need two wins out of the last four to secure a home semi-final, which is all that matters. None of them care about finishing top, because unlike in the NRL, there's no prize for finishing top.
And actually, sorry, on that note, statistically as well, it's almost one of the worst places to finish is top, historically. And the best is second and third, oddly, of teams that have finished there and won it. I think second's the most, but only a couple of sides have finished fourth and won it, like Quins last year. But finishing top, you hardly ever win it, weirdly.
But on Leicester, if you go to Quins and you're in it, you know, you're still in it after an hour with, you know, with I think two players making their first Premiership start for the club. Ollie Robinson was one of them, and you know, you bring on some big guns towards the end, but you go to Quins having made changes, and you make it, you're in it, and you lose it right at the death. I actually think that says a lot about where Leicester are, and maybe is an indication of Quins, who were full bore. You know, Leicester, if they can manage their resources and still, you know, leave there with a losing bonus, you think if they meet again when they're at full whack, it would be very different.
While we're on Leicester, there was a bit of a weird incident in that game, wasn't there, Adam, where Callum Green high tackled Joe Marler, but on review Wayne Barnes saw that Alex Donbrat had pushed Marler into the tackle, so reversed the decision. Can you just talk us through what happened there, what was going on that?
Well, it was a bit funny, having stood in front of us at our lunch on Thursday, Wayne Barnes, and said the only time he wanted to see his name in the papers was at the bottom of a match report. He was straight in the papers. I thought it was fair enough. I had the ref mic on, and he explained it quite well. Wasn't it similar to the Jack Knoll thing in Paris, where one of the French pushed him into a what looked like a bad high tackle,
and England
got a penalty. I think at the time I thought, here we go, someone's getting a red card here.
Yeah, another one.
Yeah. But after he'd explained it, once I'd seen it again, I thought it was fair enough.
So, yeah, what happened was Joe Marler had the ball and was carrying it into contact. On first viewing, it looked like Callum Green had hit him in the face with the shoulder, which he did. But the sort of mitigating factor was Alex Donbrant was behind Marler and shoved him in the back, which Wayne Barnes viewed basically forced Callum Green into making a tackle he wasn't going to make originally. So that was why that happened.
And what was the explanation that he gave, Adam? Was it about being reckless, or because I'm trying to work out why it's not legal to push your own teammate to give him momentum, when if he'd bound onto him and driven him from behind, that's legal.
Yeah, that is slightly different to Noel one. I think I got that wrong, because he was pushed by a French player, wasn't he? Noel.
But it's the same idea. It changes the picture of what's being seen. But
well, Wayne's explanation was exactly that Don Brennan had pushed Marler into Green, which had forced Green to be high on him.
I got to say, I think Green's lucky, because the penalty got reversed on the basis that Don Brandt's actions were reckless and had given Green no time to react. I mean,
I don't think
Green's going to react in that time anyway.
Yeah.
And we spoke about it last week. We've spoken about it all season. I don't understand why it's taking so long.
Yeah.
There are a lot of dynamic situations that happen, and we understand that. And Charlie Yules has spoke to you about that earlier this season after the England game and the England red card he got. But Sam Bedloe,
that was a crazy one. Friday night.
On Friday night. Bristol, he's always high. And what sticks in my mind from the Charlie Yules one for England against Ireland was the referee said, "You have taken the risk of this happening by going in like that."
Yeah.
And at the moment, we're still in a situation where players seem happy to take that risk. Yeah. And I don't quite get it, because, you know, I think Callum Green got lucky, because I don't see him in any way looking like he's about to drop his height to make a chest-high tackle. He's there to soak up Marlowe and try and get over him on the ball.
The Bedloe one, we haven't spoken to him, so we don't know, but to me it just looked like he was so pumped up, because about a minute before that, he'd made an unbelievable carry where he'd bowled over about four blokes, thrown an out-the-back offload to Dan Thomas, who put Toby Fricker away for a try. And it was almost like the next action he has is smashing someone in the face, and you just think that he's high on adrenaline or something. But that was just a crazy tackle. He was never, ever going to get the guy lower than the chin.
But also, it's a week after his teammate got sent off for not exactly the same thing, but it's just, we have all the conversation and referees get criticised for red cards, and it's like, don't do everything you can to not be in that position. And it was a really interesting moment, and it would be fascinating to sit down with Wayne to actually talk it through, because he is one of the best at explaining these situations. Yeah. And it caught me a little by surprise that trying to give a teammate a shove to get him over the line or to get him over the gain line could actually be an offence. And I guess it's the sharpness of acceleration that it would have given to Marlowe, which would probably more than if he'd latched onto him from behind and tried to shove him forward. But mind you, I also thought of that watching Tyson Fury on Saturday night when he landed the uppercut, and it was then like this, like he shoved him over two-handed. I'm like, pretty not sure you're allowed to do that.
Well, Pat Lamb on after the game on Friday on that Bedloe thing, which was absolutely stone cold red, wasn't it? He didn't have any complaints, but he seemed to think that there weren't enough reds being given.
Weren't enough.
Yeah,
there's records in the Champions Cup.
We could have a flurry of them if Pat gets his way.
Something's got to get the message through.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, there we go. So we don't need to cover off every single game, but just a little note on an extraordinary collapse from Bath against Northampton, where they were 31-12 up with about 58 minutes gone and ended up losing 36-31. Alex Mitchell pulling the strings really nicely there. But you can't be doing that, can you? 19 points up? That's not great, is it?
Well, in the week, Chris Boyd said if they lost that game, that was their season done. Mm-hmm. And they were absolutely done, weren't they?
Yeah. So just to round that off then about the Prem, we talk about the run-in. I'm going to ask you both to nail your colours to the mast, then we will clip this up and play it back to you when you've got it wrong.
I'll just, on Bath, before you put us on the hot spot. A. Griffiths has gone in there as chairman, and they strike me as a club like Leicester have been, where they need an absolute
bottoming out.
Yep. Like, you don't lose games like that unless things are wrong. And you know, it's a rugby city, and Leicester used the opportunity that they had. You know, they were in a spiral for going on a decade, downward spiral. Mm. COVID did not help anyone, but it gave them a chance to make some really tough, painful, difficult decisions. And it was absolutely what that club needed. And it feels like, to me, Bath have lurched from bad decision to bad decision. You know, Bruce Craig had so much authority there that, you know, Tabai Matson's now leading Harlequins.
Yeah.
He was at the recreation ground and left. And the word is that he didn't like the kind of the way that club was being managed, and that players were being signed that hadn't necessarily been signed off by coaches. It's lurched from one crisis to another, and actually they need the same. They need a bottoming out. It'll be fascinating to see what Ed Griffiths does there, because the culture that exists at Saracens was you know, he was the architect of a lot of that, a lot of the
all the trips and things.
Yeah,
like that.
And,
yeah,
and just the looking after the players and building a creche within the training ground, all the small details that made it a place that guys wanted to go and work and not leave. Was the, you know, the heartbeat of what has made that club what it is.
They are trying, aren't they? Because a couple of weeks ago, a few of the young players played a Premiership Rugby Cup game on a Tuesday night, like Gabe Hamer-Webb and those guys, and then they went on a bus trip all the way from Bath to Poland via five or six different countries to give aid and help to for the Ukraine crisis. I mean, it's those little tiny things like that, just building relationships.
I think they've been on a boozy trip as well, like a team built, you know, not that it showed, or maybe it did show. Maybe it did show, but I just think that they're a club who need a massive cultural overhaul.
Well, there is talk of them moving out of Farley House. Now, we've all been there. It's like a country club, isn't it? I'm sure Ed Griffiths' heart would have sank when he saw that place, which is, I mean, back in the day when Wasps were winning European Cups, they were actually proud that they trained in such a dump.
Yeah, but I'm not sure. Like, England won the World Cup training at Pennyhill Park. Yeah. Like, that's not spit and sawdust.
Well,
like, it doesn't
true.
just because your facilities are good doesn't mean that you don't work hard. But if there's a feeling that really good, comfortable facilities are leading to the club not work, the players not working hard enough or not playing, then that points back to this cultural issue. So maybe as a way of addressing that, that's what Ed Griffiths is looking at. But if having a really good training ground is a reason for playing poor rugby, then you've got a big issue, I think.
I remember talking to Sam Underhill about that exact point of, is Farley House a bit too comfortable? And he said something on the lines of, like, well, if you like grade two listed buildings, then it's great, but I don't think it has any effect on the team. But we'll see. I mean, yeah, we'll see what happens on that front and with Bath in general. I mean, we should note at this point, too, that there was a little bit of news at the end of last week, following on from a couple of weeks ago when we chatted to Ben Ward from Ealing, Trailfinders, about their bid for promotion. They've now withdrawn their promotion appeal against the decision not to let them up. So they will not be coming up into the Premiership. We'll have 13 next season again, and all the glory of bye weeks and all that. And then and the last one, I think I should note too, that in the league below that, a lovely story that Caldy won National One, fully amateur club in the Wirral and Merseyside, and there were some amazing videos of, I think they were just basically live broadcasting their court session in the bar. So they're fully amateur, but they're in the Championship with the likes of Ealing next season, so well played to them. Right, so I promised you both to put you on the spot for the top four.
I thought we distracted you long enough.
Yeah. So who are you nailing your colours to the mast then for? Northampton, Exeter, Gloucester. Let's assume that Quins are going to get through and finish in one of the four positions.
Well, Alex is sort of swaying me away when he says that it could be decided on who nicks a couple of losing bonus points, but I am still going to stick with Exeter to come fourth.
Okay, Alex?
Yeah, I think as a team most likely to nick a losing bonus, X are probably them. It feels bold to back Northampton because they've been so hot and cold this season. And I mean, just looking at the table here, Exeter have only won, they've lost 10 out of 22.
Amazing.
But, you know, they go into this mini period now with a 1 point advantage over the others, Northampton. Just wonder whether that 1 point advantage with Newcastle on the last day gives them an opportunity to nail that fourth spot.
I think them knowing what they have to do, like watching everyone this weekend coming up with a bye, then having 10 days off as Rob Baxter's giving them, and then two to know exactly what they need to do. It reminds me of a season about 7 or 8 years ago where Quins were nowhere and they knew they had two games at home, I think, to end the season and knew they had to bonus point win both of them and they managed it. And you think, possibly, is that the scenario for Exeter this time? They know exactly what they need to do. But it would be fun, wouldn't it, if we had two derbies in the playoffs of Leicester, Northampton and then Quins, Saracens.
At least Midlands and a London derby would be great.
I guess that last weekend, which is the 4th of June.
Long time.
It's a long time away. Yeah. There's a lot of European rugby to be played. We're sort of assuming here that Quins and Saracens will go will go full bore at those games. They might not need to.
Yeah.
And that might then have an impact on us. So you can imagine Northampton that playing Newcastle on the last day thinking that a win would be enough, and then Quinns or Saracens decide to rest a few players and it not going down too well at Franklin's Gardens. But on the basis that everyone goes full whack, I'll say Northampton but not with enormous confidence, right, because okay. It feels so weird to back against Exeter.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll see how it all washes up. We've got another round of Prem, bit of Europe, then we're back into it, and we'll still be here come the 18th of June when the final is. Then there's a summer tour. There's lots of rucking still left to go. But next, we'll turn our eyes towards the big game in the Women's Six Nations coming up on Saturday. Grand Slam is on the line as France hosts England, and England's Marley Packer, who's player of the match in the Ireland game, is up with us next.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So your guys are flying over to France right now, aren't you? So that's a long week of prep. Is that sort of with World Cup stuff in mind and all that?
Yeah, I think so, and just making sure that like we get all our preparation right. So we've obviously got quite a long travel day today because we come from Leicester, got the bus down to Heathrow, which we're at now, and then we've got a couple of hours here before then our flight. So I just think then we get the recovery right over in France, making sure we're hitting the right sessions, and yeah, ready to go on Saturday.
Perfect. So take us back then to Sunday. How was that? I mean, record crowd for a women's game in England, wasn't it? That must have been pretty special. Yeah. And an amazing day for Emily Scarrett as well.
Oh, yeah. So, like, the crowd are just getting better and better. We had a record crowd at Gloucester, and then to go up to Leicester and then get another record crowd is just phenomenal. And what a place to do it in Leicester, where Emily Scarrett comes from, to get 100 cup. It was a dreamboat day, really.
Yeah. Just, we've talked about her on this podcast a bit, and she's an amazing ambassador for the women's game, and to reach that 100, and she's even missed a year or so of games, hasn't she? So she could be well ahead of that if she hadn't. So,
yeah, definitely. But then also she's been in the sevens setup as well.
Yeah.
She's been to the Olympics. She's been to the sevens World Cup. So there's not much she hasn't done. But obviously the accolade of getting 100 cuts, she thoroughly deserves it. She's not just an incredible player, but she's an incredible person and friend. So yeah, I'm super proud to be able to be on the pitch with her while she was getting 100 cuts.
Yeah, she got a nice little gold cap as well. That's quite cool, isn't it?
Yeah, no, really cool. So previous players also had that. And then also, like, you get this like little trophy.
Mm.
So you get one on your 50th, which is like a silver one, and you get engraved. And then obviously 100 cap, you get a gold one. So yeah, it's just really nice. Like, it's a fitting thing for them. Like, it's such an amazing achievement to be able to keep going and keep your body in the right place to be at the top of the level for so long like she has.
Yeah, absolutely. So how are the bodies after that? Because it was quite a physically intense game, wasn't it? At least for the first half. I mean, there's a few sore bodies on that flight over this afternoon.
Yeah, definitely, myself included. But I think it's like, it's a game of rugby, you know, it's going to be a physical one. So it's just making sure we get the right recovery in and making sure that we're looking after ourselves, really.
Yeah, so Sarah Hunter had a little bit of a rib injury, and Poppy Clearall was on crutches. How are they both? Are they doing all right?
Yeah, they're both in good spirits. So I just think we'll just see how the week goes. But yeah, no, they seem to be both in really good place.
Yeah, nice. So talk to us a bit about this tournament as a whole then. I mean, Simon Middleton, the coach, has been changing the team a little bit each week, but and building up and winning games. You've only conceded 10 points and now it's a massive one over in France, both chasing a Grand Slam. How's it been going through this whole tournament, probably knowing that the final game is absolutely going to be the one?
I think it's for us, like taking each game as it comes, it sounds like quite cliche, but we need to make sure we put out a performance. And obviously with the different personnel change a lot and mid seeing different teams, we needed to make sure that actually we galvanised together and put on a performance. I think we obviously knew France was going to be the big game at the end of the tournament, so I think we've looked at the games to be a little bit more like a World Cup setup. And like on Sunday was our semi-final and this is our final coming into it this week with a 6-day turnaround, so it's about making sure that the bodies recover well, we get things right this week and then go from there. Like France are in our pool at the World Cup, so I think this is like we obviously play them quite a lot, but this is like one of those things that I doubt we'll get to play them again now until the World Cup. So we need to make sure we do a job on them.
Marley, hi, it's Alex here. Just with the World Cup in mind, you've beaten France 9 times in a row. You are playing them in the pool, but also certainly looking in from the outside, we've all been expecting this to be the Six Nations decider. How much in your team's mentality has it been like key to keep setting the standards for everyone else in the world? You know, you've beaten France, you beat the Black Ferns last time they came over. You know, you've got a world title to try and win later this year, but yeah. In terms of the standards that you yourselves are trying to set, how much of it is there a motivation that you're trying to do it to set the global standards?
I think the motivation comes from within. Like, we're driving our standards all the time, which then drives, I guess, the global standards. But I just think we keep looking at ourselves as being the best version of us in how we want to play in our game plan. I think with the World Cup coming up, in obviously we had a great All International against New Zealand, but if you look at that New Zealand squad that has been named since then, there's a lot of different players, different faces that obviously been on the seven circuit or have had some time out. Then also France, you say we beat them 9 times in a row, but actually the last few times we've played them, the games have been quite tight. We played them last autumn, I think it was, not this autumn, but autumn before, down at Exeter. In I think it was the last play of the game, we got to try to win the match. So
yeah, I remember the game at Twickenham too was a real tight one.
Yeah, so like even though we have beat them, it's not like they're runaway games. It is a really physical encounter, and it literally is a full 80 minutes of a real physical game, and very like smart rugby being played in it as well. It's not just all up front, the technical side. You got Decade Player of the Year in the French squad. Obviously, we got the likes of Emily Scarra in the rest of our back line, but it's a really, yeah, it's just a really physical and proper game of rugby that I love to be involved in.
Hi Marley, it's Adam here.
Hi Adam.
How you doing? Just talking of the Black Ferns, I just wondered what you made of the way they've changed their coaching structure. They brought Wayne Smith in and Mike Cronin, people like that.
I think, to be fair, I haven't got really too much of an opinion on it. Like, I concentrate on what we're doing more so. Like, I think it's good for them, but if that's what they think they needed. Like, obviously, they came over to here, I think, the last time I don't think they've ever been beaten the way we beat them in Autumn International. So, obviously, something needed to change for them.
Right.
But whether that was the coaching staff, like player personnel or whatever, but they needed to do something to make sure they put themselves in the best stead, because they've got a home World Cup and they need to make sure that they put on a world-class performance in that World Cup.
You're heading over to France now to play the French in Bayonne, and they, I guess, traditionally, we talked to yourself and other players, love going over to play in France because of the atmosphere that gets generated. Do you think in England we're catching up now? We'll mention the record crowds you've had. I mean, it always looks like such a bear pit to go and play over there. Are you creating that sort of same fervour for home games?
I think so. Like, if you look at our two home games, like, we've had record crowds of, like, 15,000. Like, I'm not being funny. I can remember Emily Scarrett's first cap where it was at Esher, and we probably had all our family and friends that we didn't need to worry about tickets for, and a couple of people with their dogs. So how the game's grown since then is phenomenal. But France have led the way with the crowds. They give us some odd kickoff times sometimes, but like, they get the crowds in, and you never know what you're going to get. Last time I played over in France, there was a brass band going start of the game, all the way through the game, right until the end, until we actually managed to join the band after the game. So they always put on, like, it's always a massive occasion for them, and they really get behind their team. But then also, they can also change their mood against their team sometimes. Mm. But like that those kind of games, when you get the crowd behind you, the games you want to be involved in, and like, it's probably cliche, but it's like that extra 16th man, and that's what the crowds have been like, the Six Nations, and not just our home games. When we played Scotland away, like, that was a phenomenal crowd as well. Obviously, I want a part of the Italy away game, but like, people are really recognising women's rugby and wanting to come and watch, and they flick it on BBC Two sometimes, and then they're hooked and they can't wait to watch more and more of it. So yeah, and to be a part of that is, yeah, I love being a part of that.
Well, one last thought before we let you go, Marley. Thanks so much for all your time. And
no worries at all.
If you are to win back-to-back Grand Slams, how special would that be, just to sign it off and then pushing towards greater things at the World Cup as well?
I think for me, like, it means everything. Like, every game I play in now, it means everything, because obviously you never know when your last game is, and not that you ever think about that really, but like, I just want to keep playing at my best, and to get another back-to-back Grand Slam would just not just be great from like myself and the team, but what it does for the women's game, and yeah, that's massive. But then also going on to the World Cup, when we won the World Cup in 2014, we actually lost that Six Nations to France at Grenoble. Mm. So it'd be nice if we could get the Grand Slam win and go do a job at the World Cup. And then I can say in the same year I've won a Six Nations and a World Cup. But hey, I'm not looking too far ahead. Got a job to do on Saturday first.
Oh, amazing, Marley. Well, all power to you guys, and safe trip over to Bayonne, and best of luck for the weekend. I think you've been fine ambassadors for the sport for the whole time you've been playing. So keep it all going. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Thanks, guys. Take care now.
Well, fantastic there to hear from Marley Packer, who was the player of the match in that 69-0 victory over the Irish on Sunday. Their French game in Bayonne on Saturday. Both teams going for a Grand Slam could be an absolute epic. More on the women's game. We've now got Jess Hayden. And after that, we'll get on to our God or Goddess of the Week.
Italy secured their first win of this year's tournament with a 20-13 win against Scotland, who remain winless at the bottom of the Women's Six Nations table. Despite leading 10-3 at half-time, Scotland slipped away in the second half as Italy's Melissa Bertoni led her side's revival. The match was not won for the ages, with 23 penalties conceded and heavy rainfall contributing to the high number of errors. In Cardiff, France's five-try flurry secured France's place in the Grand Slam decider against England this weekend. Wales crumbled against the tough opposition and particularly struggled with poor decision-making and kicking. The French scrum half, Laure Sansous, was the standout performer of the match, carving through the Welsh defence and dotting over for two tries herself. With ball in hand, Wales was stagnant and unforced errors cost them much of their momentum. A late consolation try came from super sub Sean Ed Harries to stop Wales leaving empty-handed, but France were no chiselled machine either, clocking up 30 handling errors in this match. The final score of 33-5 was the second big loss in a row for Wales, who lost 58-5 to England the week before. But there's still the all-important final round to be had this weekend. If Wales beat Italy, they will finish third, their highest Six Nations position since 2009, which was when they finished second. Scotland need a win against Ireland to avoid bottom place, where they also finish in 2019. And at the top of the table is the game we have all been waiting for, England versus France. So the fixtures for round five of the Women's Six Nations are all on Saturday, and they are Wales versus Italy at 12 p.m, which is available on S4C, France versus England at 2:15 p.m, which you can watch on BBC Two. And finally, Ireland versus Scotland at 8 p.m. on BBC Scotland.
Brilliant. Thanks, Jess. That was a strong roundup there of all the action in the women's game. Now to finish off, lads, God, Goddess, Devil, maybe? I don't think we're doing Devils this week, are we? Where are we going? Alex, should we start with you?
Not this week. Yeah, I'll start. Back on Thursday of last week was the Rugby Writers' 60th anniversary lunch. 2 years late because of COVID, but we did it. And the Rugby Writers Club is a sort of an... It's not a union. It's an unusual... It's a collective of all of us who work in the rugby media, who are rivals professionally, but because we spend so long on the road, so long on tours, you build up a real friendship with people from other newspapers, broadcasters, photographers. It's called the Rugby Writers. It's now really the rugby media. And we had just a wonderful day in London with some special guests who've won our awards down the years. Will went out to hand this year's award over to Antoine Dupont, who we had to cancel the dinner for obvious reasons, but we managed to get the lunch on. And my God of the Week will go to Duncan Beck, who is the chairman of the Rugby Writers. It's a role that I've done. It's not easy, and to arrange a dinner or a lunch in this case with Sir Gareth Edwards, Jill Burns, Lawrence Dallaglio was there. We had Sean Edwards turn up, and we had some great speakers. Wayne Barnes received a special award and spoke brilliantly on stage. And it was just a great time to catch up with for me, people who were writing when I came through, who I admired then and admire now, guys like Chris Hewitt and Steve Bale, and Di Llewellyn, who pulled me to one side and had just had some lovely things to say. And it was a real special occasion to reflect on 62 years now of this sort of body that is designed to try and further the interests of rugby and rugby media, but also look ahead. Sarah Mockford was there, as she was our first female chairman. She's quite happy to be called chairman. It was lovely. We were looking at lots of reflections, but also it showed a lot of change in the industry of the rugby media. I think it showed how progressive it's becoming. It was just a wonderful day, and Duncan Beck did a great job as the chairman. So roll on the 70th anniversary when it might be your job, Will.
Yeah, blimey. I'm here with two former chairmen, actually. So Adam, you did it in 2012-ish, something like that?
2012 to 2014, yeah. Chris Robshaw and Lee Halfpenny were my Pat Marshall winners.
Yeah, okay, perfect. So, yeah, no, it was a great afternoon and then became an evening. And we've got no idea why Eddie Jones calls us a lunch club. I mean, I just don't understand that. It's very strange, isn't it? But... No, just on a quick note on that, the pair of trainers that Lawrence Dallaglio wore with a nice blue suit were extraordinary.
I did tell him he looked like Rafa Nadal when he came in.
And Sean Edwards also had a nice little pair. I think it's a French thing, isn't it, of this? A bit like Gus Pichet did when he was World Rugby. It was like smart but casual. Yeah. Right, Adam?
Well, just firstly, Duncan, who's a great mate of ours. We call him the COVID chairman. He hasn't had to organise two dinners because they've been called off. But he did do a very good job. It was a great afternoon. Not such a great afternoon was Saturday at Harlequins, where halfway through the first half, I had the blue screen of death on my laptop, which is a complete nightmare. Now, in the glory days, you'd run out of the ground to find a call box and call a copy take on a free phone number. Only one person in Fleet Street does that now, as far as the copy, which is Stephen Jones of this parish. Which meant he didn't have to use his laptop, which he lent it to me so I could finish my work off. Otherwise, you'd just be looking at a blank sheet of paper in the Sunday papers. So Stephen Jones is my God of the Week for lending me his laptop.
Extraordinary. We've got two journalists nominated.
That's after everything you said in this pod about Owen Farrell. He didn't even get a mention in your God of the Week. I can't believe it.
Well, honourable mention to the returning Owen Farrell, back to form, but I feel like it'd be nice to round off with a nomination for a goddess. Emily Scarrett won her 100th cap in her hometown. She got a farm round the corner. They're at Welford Road at Leicester. They gave her a nice gold cap. She's the 8th centurion, 6th woman to reach the 100. And they also get like a little extra gold little plaque thing as well, which was nice. But what an amazing player. She's a former winner of the Pat Marshall as well.
She is. In fact, it was my first year as chairman. Mm. there was a tie in the voting as to who was going to win our Pat Marshall Award. The Pat Marshall Award is the rugby personality of the year. It can be coach or player. Or there was a tie, and I had the chairman's vote.
Oh.
And voted for Emily Scarrett to win it.
There you go.
I've forgotten who came second.
Johnny Wilkinson.
Right, okay. Yeah. To oust Johnny,
yeah.
Who that would have been his second.
Johnny was given the special award that year anyway.
Sure, for Toulon and...
So I had the pleasure of awarding the casting vote and then presenting her with the award, although we did have to wait because when Al Eakin, who was doing the MC and gave her gave it all the big build up, announced Emily Scarrett's name, and she was nowhere to be seen. Like, someone had to rush off to the ladies to go and find her.
Funny. Well, look, she's been a goddess of many weeks before, but particularly this week. Well played to Emily Scarrett, and probably another 100 caps to come, probably, and then maybe another World Cup to win in September. But there's our gods and goddesses of the week. And you've been listening to The Ruck from the Times and the Sunday Times. We'll be definitely back here next week and every week throughout the season, bringing the latest discussion, insight. So follow, subscribe from wherever you get your podcasts from. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.